Okay, this is WGXC 90.7 Accra, the Wave Farm Radio for Open Ears. This is the latest installment of my show. It's called Reading is Funkdamental. It's a monthly show where we talk about great books about music. And my name is Sal Cataldi. I'm a local musician. I play with a band called Spaghetti Easter Music and Guitar as a Go-Go. And I also write about music for Pop Matters, New York Times, New York State Music, and this book we're going to talk about is about one of my favorite bands, The Zombies. We have the author, Robin Platz, here, who's written a comprehensive survey of this incredible band, which seems to get more popular with each year. Not going to waste a lot of time with telling you about it because we have a long interview here, almost an hour. So let's just hand it over to Robin, and hope you enjoyed that little track I played at the beginning. That is an upcoming single called Marimba Joe Blues from Spaghetti Easter Music. So here we go, Robin Platz. Okay, here we are. Our guest today is Robin Platz, who's written a fantastic book about one of my favorite bands and one of a lot of people's favorite bands, young and old, because their music is very timeless. It's a mix of genre, The Zombies. So let's speak about first about you. Like, when did you discover this band and I guess music in general? And why did you decide to write the book? And what was the whole process of writing the book?
All right, this could be a long story. And
go ahead, we got time.
We're gonna have to go back about 50 years or so. I mean, how old am I that I'm able to relate something from 50 years ago? I'm thinking as I say this. I was born in 67, so I narrowly missed the 60s. But from being age 5 or 6, I was obsessed with 60s music. I think I was about 5 or 6 years old. I became aware of the Beatles, it's Simon and Garfunkel, and the Animals, and just loved that stuff. And so the 60s has always been like this mythical era to me, always seemed like this faraway, magical time. Mm-hmm. So I loved all that stuff. And then I was about 9 years old, it would have been about 1976 or so, some friends of my parents had this album. It was one of those great K-Tel compilations from the
70s. Yeah, fantastic.
Yeah, and this was called The Best of Britain. And this was the time, I think, when people in the 70s were, various reasons, starting to look back fondly on the sounds of the 60s and everything. So K-Tel did this thing, packaging together, it was probably like, 20 tracks from the British invasion and British acts from the 60s. And I had this, and I think we had a tape of it. It was probably one of those like Realistic Radio Shack cassette mm-hmm. tapes of the era, right? Yeah. and it was amazing to me because I'm hearing things for the first time, like the Kinks and Donovan and all these other acts that I'd never heard before. And on there, of course, is this track called Time of the Season by the Zombies. And it was just like, what is this? I mean, it sounded like nothing I'd ever heard before. And I think, we may touch on this again, but I think a big part of the Zombies' appeal is the magic of when somebody first discovers them. And so that mm-hmm. was that moment for me, this ethereal sound, this ghostly voice, sort of strange lyrics, Time of the Season, what's that all about? And so I was obsessed with this track, but I knew nothing at all about them. And then as I grew older, when I had, my own, minimal budget to buy records, I bought a Greatest Hits, and then probably when I was about 17 or 18 or something, a friend of mine turned me on to Odyssey and Oracle. And I was a bit leery at first because I thought, it sounds like another one of these 60s concept psychedelic mm-hmm. trip albums. But he's like, no, you got to hear this, And played it for me. And I was completely hooked and went on to, buy. Going in the mid to late 80s, there seemed to be a lot of different Zombies compilations coming out.
Right, and the tribute albums too.
Yeah. And so I was picking up all of these. And then I went on to sort of embark on, a writing career of sorts and managed to interview all of them all the original five Bad members in 94 and into early 95, which ended up becoming a cover feature in Goldmine magazine. Yeah. And it was, you know, I spent an hour or two, I think, on the phone with all five of them and went through the whole career. And the Goldmine thing came out. And because at that time, I knew virtually nothing about them. There, it seems to me like there was not a lot of available literature at that time. So I did that and, you know, did some other stuff for Goldmine and Discoveries magazine and Mojo and a few others, through the '90s. And I was quite excited when, you know, a book about them came out. Somebody wrote a book about them in I think it was around 99 or 2000 and it came out and I was like, yeah, this is okay. And without, you know, I mean, I know very well how much work goes into one of these things and how much you have to dedicate yourself and how much effort it takes. And, but the book, when I read it, I wasn't quite the book I was looking for as a Zombies fan. And over the years, there were one or two others that came out and I was like, well, you know, this is fine, but it's not the Zombies book that I want to read just for my own personal self. And so at some point over the years, this is kind of a gradually evolving process. There was, you know, this idea in my mind that the Zombies book that I wanted just for myself didn't exist yet. And I'm also aware that I've got, you know, piles of tapes of these interviews that I did with the band in 94, 95. And then I'd interviewed Colin Blunstone a couple more times or three more times after that. I did some liner notes for an album he did of BBC Sessions and a few other things. So I've got this wealth of material and I think, well, maybe, you know, maybe I could do this. And so, you know, it just evolved over a period of years and there it is. And I think for me, it succeeded. This is the book that I wanted to read. And
right.
I hope others will feel the same way.
Well, how did you hook up with the folks from Hozak Publishing? Because this is kind of their lane, if you will.
Yeah, that was an interesting story, really in itself, because I'd been researching Colin's solo career and getting into all that stuff, and through that, became aware of Edward Rogers and his wife Melanie,
right? Former publicist as
right.
myself, yes,
that's right. And it was funny too because there was a connection there with a group called Bedsit Poets.
Yes, sure.
Which is right. Which and they had a track. I think it was a Summer That Changed, which I'd actually had on, you know, my computer music playlist for probably like 15 years or something like that. I had no idea who they were or that there was any kind of connection to the Zombies. But I chatted with them and they had some great stories, in particular to do with sort of helping to kind of engineer Colin's career resurgence and bring him over to New York
right.
to play. But I was chatting with them and talking about looking for a publisher, and they recommended Hozak, and I went and looked and it was great. They're a very cool, you know, record label and publisher as well
right,
too.
Right,
and I thought this is, you know, it seemed like a cool way to go and approach it. And they've been just fantastic to work with. And I also, it's a funny thing because going through the process of doing this book, of course, you know, in the latter stages, you're seeing all these PDF proofs and making little edits and things like that, right? And I remember looking at the PDF and thinking, yes, looks good. This looks good. But when I actually got the book, when the book arrived, it was a few weeks ago now, a box of books arrived in the mail. And I remember pulling this thing out and I thought, this looks nice. Just holding it in my hands, it looks beautiful. So yeah, it's been really, been
no,
really
it's nice
work.
Quality paper. And,
yes.
And again, as I did in my review for Pop Matters, the, it's really well, very nicely illustrated, which some of these books, you know, for various rights and things don't really live up to the text, if you will.
Yeah. But,
so let's
and I should say too, with Hozak too, it's funny, the thing when I went and after Ed and Melanie had recommended them, I went and kind of looked at their website. And the thing that sort of tipped it for me was the fact that they had put out a book about Chris Bell from Big Star.
Right.
And I immediately thought, anyone who's publishing a book on Chris Bell is God Be All Right.
Yeah.
That was my rationale. And
the whole thing is, it does have it has this great appeal to, you know, sort of people of our, I'm a little older than you, my generation, your generation. I think we're kind of about 10 years apart. Okay. But also the main thing is this, you know, it's a kind of a band that gets reverence and rediscovered with sort of each new generation of music listeners. So, you know, I'm sure you have and the books that they write, a book like Chris Bell's book, I'm sure there's plenty of young 20 something musicians and music fans who are just as into that book as the people who were there, you know, when they came around the first time. But let's start really with the band is really sprung from the chief architect is Rod Argent and his musical influences. So let's start with Rod. His entry into music, what his early inspirations are, what his listening was, and how that kind of influenced the band as he was the sort of the principal songwriter.
Right. I mean, Rod, in doing the book, Rod seemed like the obvious place to start. I mean, without Rod, you don't have the Zombies. He was the driving force in the whole thing coming together. And you've got a kid who, his dad was in a dance band, but he didn't really like popular music that much when he was young, when he was a young kid. He had a lot of influence of classical music, which his mother liked. I think Tchaikovsky and things like that. He starts playing piano at a very early age and also singing in the St. Albans Cathedral Choir. So that's kind of where he's coming from. I think he was senior chorister in the choir. And then he's got a cousin, Jim Rodford, who's about 4 years older. And Jim is in a band called the Blue Tones. And Jim's trying to get Rod into rock and roll music. And I think he hears some Bill Haley, and Rod's not sold on Bill Haley. And then Jim plays him Hound Dog by Elvis when Rod's about 11, I think. And as Rod said, in typical Rod Argent fashion, he said it just, you know, completely blew my world apart. And the funny thing with Rod is I've spoken to him a few times between, you know, the mid-90s and up till, you know, a year or two ago. When you hear him talk about Elvis, you know, whether he's in his 40s or in his 70s, he sounds like he's just heard Hound Dog for the first time 5 minutes ago, and he can't wait to tell you how good it is. This is a guy who's gotten, just an enthusiast, a guy, and an enthusiast for a very wide range of music. So he's, you know, when he's in the Cathedral Choir, he's mesmerized by Bach. Then he gets hooked on Elvis and doesn't want to listen to anything else except Elvis. And he's getting drawn into, you know, the music that inspired Elvis and things like Ray Charles. And then he discovers Miles Davis. And that's, you know, that this becomes his new obsession. He sells his Elvis records to buy a Miles Davis album. Which he still
regrets.
Yeah, that's right. But he just has this this wide ranging absorbing of music, which, as he said to me, he said it all seemed like it came from the same well. Like, he at one point he talks about hearing a particular piece of classical music, and he said to me it sounded like a blues song. So it's all one thing to him. And I think all that feeds into the influences that then will later come out when he starts writing and recording his own material with the Zombies.
So how did the band come together? Obviously, Rod is the central driver. So how do they ultimately come together? And then talk a little bit about their early days up till the when they win the competition, the bit, sort of this battle of the bands, which sets them up with Decca Records.
Right. So at around 15 or so, I think the thing that really tipped him was he goes to see a gig by the Blue Tones, this group that his cousin Jim is playing bass in. And Rod decides he wants to form a rock and roll band. This is his driving force now. And I think it takes a couple of years, but he doesn't really know anyone that's a likely candidate to join, apart from Jim, but Jim's 4 years older. And, you know, as you get older, 4 years doesn't seem like a huge difference. But I think when you're 15 and the other guy's 19, it's a big deal. And I think Jim probably thought, well, I don't want to be in a band with a 15-year-old. Excuse me.
Yeah, no problem.
So Rod finds Paul Atkinson, who's in the school music club. And so he finds Paul in a classroom playing guitar. And, you know, it's a very simple process of, you know, do you want to be in a group? Do you want to be in a band? Paul says, sure, okay. So Rod says, all right, we need a drummer. Where can I find a drummer? And the school they went to in St. Albans had, you know, an Army Corps thing that the kids all had to do. And one of the parts of that was a marching band. And so Rod goes and stakes out the marching band to find a drummer. And he spots the guy who he thinks looks like he's got the best rhythm. And that's Hugh Grundy. Mm-hmm. And so again, you know, do you want to join a band? Okay, great, fine. Needs a bass player now. And he's aware, Rod is aware that his neighbor and friend, a guy called Paul Arnold, plays a bit of guitar, but Paul's also building a bass for a school woodwork project.
It was quite common in those days with the
right. Breath. Right. And so he's building this bass. It's not finished, but that's enough to get him in the band. So Paul says, all right. And Paul goes to a different school. This is Paul Arnold goes to a different school, where, because they sit in alphabetical order, A for Arnold, he sits next to a kid who is B, Colin Blunstone, who plays guitar. And, you know, Paul talks him into joining, and so they all go along and have a practice session at a place called the Pioneer Club in St. Albans. And the idea at this point, again, Rod's the driving force, and it's going to be two guitars, bass and drums, kind of classic lineup, and Rod is going to be the lead singer. But then Colin hears Rod playing a thing called Nut Rocker, which was a hit at that time.
Right.
I think early 62 or so, by a group called B. Bumble and the Singers. So I think it's a rock and roll version of the Nutcracker Suite. Mm-hmm. And so Colin says, well, you know, why is this guy not playing in the band? And then at the same, that same first practice, Colin is sitting during a break and strumming his guitar, and he starts singing a Ricky Nelson song. And Rod hears Colin singing and realizes that, you know, this guy should be the lead singer. So they sort of come to an agreement that, okay, I'll play piano if you be the lead singer. And so throughout this whole really very informal process, they've put together 4/5 of the lineup that would go on to make She's Not There, Tell Her No, Odyssey and Oracle, and all the original Zombies records. And
how soon was it from the time they formed, you know, this original band coalesced, till the time they won the Hertz Beat competition and then had their first recordings with Decca?
This is one of those things where, you know, people's memories vary a little bit as to when they actually, you know, when they first got together, when they practiced. It's either 2 or 3 years, depending. Mm-hmm. It's certainly a couple of years. And so, and it's a couple of years for them of, you know, finding a name, starting to play local dances and gigs like that around St. Albans and the local area there. And then as we move into 1964, you know, there's other things going on. The Beatles have become massive in the UK by early 64. And I think they're just about to invade America. Mm-hmm. At the beginning of the year. But in Britain, the Liverpool sound or the Mersey sound is massive. With you've got, you know, Jerry and the Pacemakers, Billy J. Kramer, Swingin' Blue Jeans, all these groups. But there's because the Liverpool scene has probably been pretty much plundered for talent by this point. So there's a great interest in Britain, I think, in finding the next sort of musical mecca. And one of the places that comes up as a potential source of new talent is a town called Watford, which is sort of situated north of London and south of St. Albans, where the Zombies are from. And so the London Evening News newspaper partners with the Watford local council to launch a contest, and they call it Hearts Beat, which is a play on words of the county of Hertfordshire, where mm-hmm. Watford and St. Albans are situated. So the Zombies decide to go into this competition, just sort of, you know, for a laugh. I don't think they're necessarily considering turning professional at this point, but they win. And so they decide to put off going to university and try turning pro for a year and see what happens.
So there was some a little confusion. Was the prize for this contest an actual recording deal with Decca, or was it sort of a demo deal? Or did you ever get to the bottom of that?
I've seen it was there was definitely a cash prize involved.
Right.
Although people's memories, this is one of those things where memories seem to vary. I know in newspaper accounts and things at the time, there's reference to a cash prize, but some of them remember, you know, a demo session or a recording session being part of it. I remember, you know, when I asked Paul Atkinson, 20 odd years ago, Paul said that he just remembers, you know, there being a 250-pound prize, which, as he pointed out, was a lot of money in those days. It may have been too that there wasn't a recording contract wasn't a guaranteed part of it, but there was maybe an assumption that the prestige of winning this thing is going to, you know, guarantee that you're probably going to get interest from record labels, which of course did happen.
So they become an immediate success right out of the box with their first recording, which was She's Not There. And then you also talk about, so let's talk a little bit about that, the you know, how that came about, the style of it. It's a Rod Argent competition. And then again, how their, I guess it's their publishing company insisted to them that they try to write original material, which is where this came from. And that you say they're one of the few British invasion bands to actually get paid for their efforts because they had a kind of honest, I guess, management, or publishing company.
Yeah. It seemed to me like they lucked out. Really, in terms of at least the sort of production and publishing side of things, because of course after they won Heartbeat, they did get an offer right away from Decca Records after winning, but they were in a position where I think they weren't desperate. I think three out of the band members were planning to go to university that fall of 64. So they could afford to sort of take a beat and step back and consider their options rather than just rushing to sign on the dotted line. And so Chris White had an uncle who knew a guy named Ken Jones. Ken Jones was a musician, writer, conductor, arranger. And he had a company called Marquis Enterprises, sort of production. And they did jingles and things as well too. And so they met with him and ended up signing with Marquis Enterprises for sort of a production deal and a lease tape deal whereby Marquis, Ken Jones and Marquis would record them and produce them and own the recordings that they would make, which would then be leased out, to Decca Records.
Right.
So they would own the rights and Decca would lease the rights to them for a certain period of time so they could put them out. And as a result of that, they, you know, kept getting their royalties and were less susceptible to a lot of the usual ripoffs that went on, although they did get ripped off in other ways and other areas. But in terms of their recordings and their publishing, they did well and still managed to get, you know, their royalties. And really what's amazing, too, is they signed that deal in mid-64, and they stayed with Marquis for close to 60 years. In fact, it was while I was working on the book, actually.
Right.
It was the summer of 2023. They finally, the band themselves formed a company and bought back the rights to their recordings from Marquis Enterprises. But for that 60 years or so in between, they were overseen by Marquis, all the licensing for compilations, movies, and everything. So it was quite a successful story.
So She's Not There. So what's the feel of that? I mean, do you, in your opinion, the kind of influences that kind of played into that. So they had actually two hits that year, which would be their last hits for a while. So there was She's Not There. And then they had a second single that didn't do as well. And then Tell Her No was the third single. If you can take me through that.
That's right. Yeah. So, I mean, the original idea after they signed to Decca was, I think the plan was that they were going to do Summertime as their first single. That was the assumption because that was the big fan favorite number that they did at the time. And they weren't really doing original material. I think they had one of Rod's songs and maybe they'd done some of Chris's too, but they were mostly playing covers at that point. And Summertime was their signature number that brought the house down when they were playing things like that. But when they were booked to go in for their first session at Decca Records in the summer of 64, Ken Jones, their producer with Marquis, said, you know, should write something for the session. Because, of course, at this point in time, the idea of the artist writing their own stuff is very much coming into vogue more and more, I think, you know, the Beatles and various other acts. So, you know, in the week or so leading up to the session, Chris White writes a great song called You Make Me Feel Good. But then Rod goes away and writes something quite different. And typically for Rod, he's getting influences from all over the place. There's definitely a jazz sound to it. He's also getting a chord sequence that is inspired by Brian Hyland's song, Sealed with a Kiss. And if you go back and listen to Sealed with a Kiss, you can sort of hear shades of She's Not There in some of the chords. Not a direct lift, but you can hear where he got the influence in there. And he's also got a John Lee Hooker song, so he's got the blues influence there. There's a John Lee Hooker song called No One Told Me, and that becomes the starting point for the lyrics, and for a while is the working title. And that song, of course, you know, becomes a hit pretty soon after it comes out. And the second single, Leave Me Be, was a Chris White song. Didn't do as well. And I think Parrot Records, the label in America, opted not to release it and went instead to their third UK single, which was Tell Her No. And Tell Her No, again, the influence is there. Rod has always talked about Burt Bacharach and Hal David, but particularly Burt Bacharach in terms of the music and the chords. Their first big tour that they did as the Zombies in Britain, October 64, they'd been on a package tour, which also featured Dionne Warwick, who had already had, you know, great success in America at the time. But she was also getting into the British charts with stuff like Walk On By, Reach Out For Me, things like that. So Rod has said that those, you know, major seventh, minor ninth type chords that he was hearing in the Bacharach and David songs were quite a strong influence on Tell Her No.
So then they have basically, I'm not sure of the count, but after Tell Her No, there's a fallow period of, like, I guess 7 to 9 singles kind of either fail or completely fail or really fail. And they are not asked to make a second album by their label, is not interested. So this is where things get very interesting for all us fans, where they decide to fund the second album, that becomes Odyssey and Oracle. So let's talk a little bit about how they kind of came to decide to break up, and this kind of swan song album.
Right. So, I mean, after She's Not There and Tell Her No had done well, there's a fairly rapid decline in a way, really. I mean, they go from beginning of 65 being at the top of the U.S. charts, at least in Cashbox. I think they were number two in Billboard with She's Not There, and then Tell Her No does well. But by the end of, I think by the end of 65, you know, they can barely make it into the top 100 in Billboard. So that it's, you know, a fairly steady decline going on there. And then in 66, the following year, things just get worse and worse. And, you know, at the end, by early 67, Decca has lost interest in, you know, renewing the lease tape agreement with them. They don't, the story often gets told, I think that Decca dropped them. I think, don't think Decca dropped them technically, because Decca didn't really have them technically, but Decca lost interest in keeping going with the lease tape deal, and Parrot records in the US again. I don't think they even bothered to put out the last couple of singles that they'd done for Decca. So
they had, I think Parrot Records had Tom Jones, if I'm not mistaken.
That's right.
I remember buying an album for my mother called Fever Zone for Christmas. It was on Parrot Records, but we digress.
No, I remember that one, the Tom Jones Fever Zone. I mean, that's quite a place to be. And absolutely. And I think Parrot was originally, I think the original idea for Parrot was that it was going to be a sort of the London Records or Decca Records subsidiary. I think it was supposed to be devoted to trying to sign new acts from Britain, which is, I think,
so, zombies. So all this time when they're not having this success, they're pretty aggressively working the road, correct?
And
you talk about this sort of in the ripoff category is this string of concerts that they do in the Philippines and what their compensation was for that. If you could tell us a little bit about there was zombie mania was in the Philippines. And how they didn't really get paid too well for their efforts. But if you can tell us that one.
Yeah. So by the beginning of 67, they're pretty much at the end of their tenure with Decca. They've tried doing a couple of cover versions. That hasn't worked either. So they're all pretty despondent and on the verge of breaking up. And their manager, this colorful character called Tito Burns, he says, well, if you're gonna split up, would you like to see something of the Far East before you go? And so Tito tells them that they've had an invitation to perform some shows in the Philippines. And as I think I note in the book, his selling job just sort of indicates how bad their career is, because he pitches this to them as, you're guaranteed not to lose any money on this. So this is the best he can offer them at that point, is that they're not going to lose money. But they agree, and they're expecting to go over and play a few, you know, low-key gigs over there. But when they arrive, they see hordes of fans waiting at the airport. They can't figure out who they're there for. They think there must be, I think the quote was, there must be somebody famous on this plane. They're all
right,
looking around.
Right, yeah.
Maybe Tom Jones is on the plane. But yes, it turns out it's them. Apparently, zombie mania has taken hold of the Philippines, and they're going to play at this huge stadium in the Philippines, Araneta Coliseum, which holds like 40,000 people. And it's packed. They're playing 10 nights there. And I think, I don't know if it was sold out every night, but they were playing to huge crowds. And for this, I think the band collectively is getting paid 80 pounds per night. So each member is getting about 13 pounds per night for playing to a crowd of 40,000. And so they are mightily, mightily unhappy about this. And I think this becomes the last straw with Tito Burns as their manager. And I think this convinces them that it's the end of the road.
Now, what was the time? Was this before or after the Beatles had their famous incident in the Philippines with Marcos?
This was actually right after, and
even more reason not to go.
That's right. There's all these horrific headlines about, you know, terrified Beatles flee Manila or flee the Philippines, and, you know, being chased out of the country and terrorized. And Colin Blundstone was quite amused as I was reading him some of the headlines about that, and he said to me, you know, and who's the next band to go over there? Yes, it's them. A lot. I think a few acts at the time were pulling out. Apparently, Freddie and the Dreamers decided not to go, but the Zombies gamely went over there, and you know.
And that was that. So then,
yes.
So the real reason, as you reference in the book, is that, you know, really the only guys who were getting paid in this band were the songwriters, which was largely Argent, and Chris White was also developing as a songwriter at this time. So they decide before they commence to split up, they take on doing the Odyssey and Oracle, which is really the album which they're venerated for. So tell us a little bit about that and their luck in terms of lucking into Abbey Road Studios and what the Beatles left behind.
Right. So I think at this point, there's definitely talk of breaking up going on. It's a funny thing because I think the table sort of turned in terms of who wanted to break up and when. Rod and Chris had both told me that they were pretty much convinced the band was over, but because they'd been dissatisfied with the production of their earlier records on Decca, I think they wanted to kind of have a chance to prove themselves and show what they could do. And so their lease tape deal with Decca is over. But coincidentally, at the time, CBS Records in the UK has a push to sign homegrown talent from Britain. So I think they signed Georgie Fame around that time, and Jerry Marsden from Jerry and the Pacemakers, they sign up as a deal. So they're looking for UK talent. And so the Zombies find a fairly receptive place in CBS. They have, CBS gives them a modest budget. I think it was either 1,000 or £2,000. And I think by comparison, I think Sgt. Pepper, which had been recorded shortly before that, was, I think, sorry, £50,000. So they're working on a fraction of the budget that the Beatles have, but they do, as you say, they get access to Abbey Road. And they don't get very much time there. They're kind of sneaking in and out between other sessions for the Beatles and others, but they do get Abbey Road, and they get the same engineers that had worked with the Beatles. And they also get access to not an 8-track recorder exactly, because I think 4-track is the standard in Britain at the time. I think in
Right,
America
still
they had
was,
eight
yeah.
tracks, right? But they take advantage of the fact that the Beatles had the engineers there. I think, attach together a pair of 4 tracks to bounce tracks down on to basically have an 8-track thing. So they get that. And out of that, they over the a period of several months of sessions, they're able to create, a masterpiece. And they prove themselves as producers and as songwriters. But most of the rest of the world doesn't notice at the time. But it really is an amazing album, particularly you mentioned Chris White.
Right.
Rod was the one who,
He wrote seven
yeah.
of the 12 songs, so.
Yes. I mean, and Chris had been coming into his own more and more as a writer over the previous few years. I mean, he'd written some great songs that were either B-sides or weren't released at all at the time, things like I Know She Will, and in particular, I Love You, which was a B-side, which seems crazy when you hear it now that that was a B-side. But that song then was covered, became a hit for a group called People in the United States. But he really comes into his own on Odyssey and Oracle with, sadly say, 7 of the 12 tracks, some of the
Right.
best stuff on there. This Will Be Our Year has become kind of a standard. Beechwood Park changes. And it's just so this album and this access to Abbey Road, and that it coincides with one of the strongest writing periods for Rod and Chris, and they produce a masterpiece, and it flops, but over time, its reputation will grow.
Well, like you said in the book, when they came in after the Beatles, they had access to, I think John Lennon left his Mellotron there, which is very, this is like one of the great Mellotron albums, if you like that kind of thing, and I certainly do. And then, so you, like you say, it comes out, it's yet again another, doesn't make much in the way of waves until Al Kooper comes over from the States and brings it back to America, and that's when things happen.
That's right. So Al at this point has already been, establishing himself with starting off an amazing career. It's actually funny recently seeing the Dylan movie in which he features as a character. It was funny, like, hey, there's Al Kooper playing that organ part, right? So it's funny to see him as a character in that. But of course, at this point, he's gone on to form Blood, Sweat, and Tears, left after their first album. And I think by the summer of '68, I think he's just put out Super Session with Stills and Mike Bloomfield, which is going to be another big hit for him. But he's also started working as a staff producer at Columbia in the US. And he's gone over to Britain that summer for the first time and picked up a stack of 40 or so albums that weren't out in the States. And one of these is Odyssey and Oracle, which as Al famously noted, stuck out like a rose in a garden of weeds. So
And CBS had no intention of releasing it. Like many of the product, they had no intention of releasing it in the States at that time.
That's that. Right. I think whatever deal the Zombies had gave CBS the option to put it out, but it was just sitting on a shelf somewhere. And Al Cooper goes, I think, I'm not sure if Al Cooper even realizes this, but he goes to Clive Davis, and the president of CBS at the time, and walks in holding his copy of the album and tells him he should put this out. And Davis is resistant. Somebody else also advocates for the album, and eventually, reluctantly, CBS releases it in the U.S. on their subsidiary Date Records, to no great fanfare. And the whole endeavor isn't helped by the fact that
there is no band.
The songs, right? There's no band. Yeah, that's right. That's a problem for a start. There's no band. But then they also decide, of all the songs on the album, they decide that they're going to put out Chris White's song, Butcher's Tale. Yeah. A fantastic song, but right. I think most people would agree the least likely song to get played on the radio.
It's kind of like The Producers, you know, the movie The Producers. It's just like you try to agree.
That's right.
From that album, that is, it's right. a great song, like you say. But it is probably the least commercially pleasing.
Yes, if you were going to pull a Zero Mostel and try to pick a single that would flop, that's the one to pick. And I think at the time, the logic, and God knows in 1968 what they were thinking, but I think they were thinking Vietnam.
Right, and
this is a song. Yeah. A very compelling song about the horrors of war. In that case, the First World War, but I think they thought it would resonate. But it bombed. And then nothing really happens. And then at some point, somebody... and this is a case where both Al Cooper and also the Zombies publisher, a guy named Al Gallico, he was their U.S. publisher, both of them have said that they suggested putting out Time of the Season. So somebody called Al, in either case, says, try this one, one last shot, last ditch. And they put it out towards the end of 68, and it takes a few weeks, but then... beginning of 69, early 69, it ends up at number one.
Now, was that song the last song recorded for the album, if I remember correctly?
It was either last or second to last.
Was it recorded at Abbey Road, or was some of this was also recorded at Olympic Studios, correct?
Yeah. I've got actually...
I don't remember off
the top of my head, but it was definitely one of the last tracks recorded. And Rod thought it was a hit. Rod thought this has got some of the same magic as She's Not There. I think Colin and Paul Atkinson certainly has said he wasn't that keen. He saw it as a throwaway song, which seems amazing, but...
And Colin didn't want to sing it, right, originally? Was that the song you didn't want to sing?
That's right. Colin and Rod apparently got into a big argument in the studio because Rod was telling him how he should phrase a certain part of the song and how he should sing it, and Colin...
So all of a sudden they have this fantastic number, global number one or you know, top 10, top five hit, and there's no band, but, you know, that does not stop American and British ingenuity. Because there will be Zombies. They just won't be the band. So
that's
tell
right.
us a little about the, that's a fantastic rock story, the story of the fake Zombies. So if you could kind of give us a little bit of that quickly.
Yeah, I mean, it's actually hard to track. I mean, and I think the best known.
I think you did a good job.
Yeah. Oh, thanks. And in digging around, I think I discovered more fake Zombies than I think had even been reported before. But the two most famous ones were a company out of Michigan called Delta Promotions that actually had two, and again, American ingenuity at its finest. They had not one, but two fake zombie bands concurrently touring the U.S., one from Texas, one from Michigan. The Texas or the Michigan band had former members of a group called the XLs.
Right.
And then the Texas one has a couple of guys in it who later went on to achieve success as ZZ Top.
Right.
So they've got these two bands touring around. And in those days, again, pre-internet days, I think it's probably hard for people to conceive who didn't live through that era. But, you know, it was probably not that difficult to get away with that sort of thing. I think probably the average person wouldn't have known what the Zombies looked like. And again, by the late 60s, you know, everyone had long hair and beards and all that stuff. Even the Beatles, even, or the Beach Boys or any of those bands looked unrecognizable from how they looked earlier. So, you know, some guys with long hair and beards show up in a bar. No one's going to know if it's the real zombies or not.
So these bands were touring, and you know, they ultimately did get shut down, and they would also come back later on, as you said, yes. I believe in the 90s or whatever. But so the band breaks up, you know, it's kind of interesting, the career, the non-musical careers, I find very fascinating in this. You know, Paul Atkinson, the guitar player, goes into, originally, I think he wanted to be a computer programmer, and then he went into the music business on sort of the A&R side and became a hugely successful sort of talent. You know, he's the guy who discovered, who sort of pushed his record company to record ABBA, and he was the A&R guy behind a whole host of folks. Rod and Chris will continue their production partnership, first through Argent and some other acts. And then Collins is probably the most interesting. He goes into the insurance business, and then he decides to come back into the business, but he's going to use another name, even though he's going to be recording some of his old hits. So I don't know where you want to start with that, but maybe we could start with, maybe we could start with Colin.
Sure. So Colin, sorry, we'll pause there for a second.
That's okay.
So Colin, after the band splits up in early 68, Colin quits the music business. Although, as he's pointed out, he said it wasn't so much that he quit the music business, but rather he felt that the music business had quit him. He's basically got very little money to show after, you know, 4 years of zombieing. And so he just goes and takes a job in an insurance office, Sun Alliance Insurance in London, which he does for, I think, the better part of a year. But somewhere in late 68, and beginning of 69, some of this stuff is a bit hazy in terms of how much of it was the success of Time of the Season in America. But whatever the case and whatever the motivation, he hooks up with a guy called Mike Hurst, a musician who used to play with Dusty Springfield in the Springfields, and is now a producer who's producing the early records by Cat Stevens.
Right.
And so Mike wants to get together and make a record, which they do. But Mike wants to do a remake of She's Not There, a sort of an updated remake with fuzz guitar and a new arrangement. I personally like the remake. I think it's a fun version that they do. And one or the other of them, and neither of them can agree as to whose idea it was. I think they both blame the other, I think. But one or the other of them says, well, we're not going to use your real name. We're going to use a pseudonym. And so they come up with the name James MacArthur. And then somebody points out, no, there's an American actor called James MacArthur. He's on Hawaii Five-O.
Yes, Dan. Yes,
exactly. Dano, exactly. So Neil MacArthur, he becomes Neil MacArthur instead and puts out this version of She's Not There just for fun. Colin said it was just really a lark. He still got his insurance job, but it becomes a hit, you know, top 30 hit in Britain. And so he shortly quits his insurance job, puts out a couple of other singles as Neil MacArthur, but both of those flop. And so decides not to continue with that. But then at somewhere in late 69, he runs into Chris White, his old zombie bandmate, at a party. And by this point, of course, Chris and Rod Argent have been doing the band Argent for the past year or more. And they've also been producing other artists as well.
Right.
And they've got a production set up. And so Chris says, well, you know, we could produce you. And Colin's tired of being Neil MacArthur at this point. So he agrees to do an album, which is the album that eventually becomes 1 Year.
It's a wonderful album. It's also a very, you know, sort of orchestral pop thing. And it's also where Colin comes into his own, I think, as a composer himself, which was something I didn't realize the depth of his writing until I read your book. I got to kind of move it along here because we are running out of time and we're only up to like 1969. So, but we know, so that is a reason to, you know, seek out this book. And so let's just take it to where the zombies, their reunion. They come together for the 40th anniversary of Odyssey Oracle, and by that time the album is sort of enshrined by the hipsters, and there's tribute albums. So let's just take it to there and to the present with the band.
Yeah, I mean, as you say, I think through the 90s there had been a resurgence of influence. There had been a tribute album done by Pop Llama out of Seattle, and Seattle was, of course, the happening place at the time. So you got a bunch of Seattle bands and others. But there was also a San Francisco band called the Sneetches, who I personally loved at the time, never fully appreciated in their own time. But their bass player, a guy called Alec Palau, put together a box set called Zombie Heaven, which is still sort of the benchmark, I think, for zombie collections. And that creates a lot of interest. And then in 99, Rod and Colin start recording together, first just under their own names, Rod Argent and Colin Blundstone, but eventually they relent and start using the Zombie name. And all this time, Odyssey and Oracle, the album, is getting reissued periodically and growing in stature. And then for the 40th anniversary in 2008, they decide to do some reunion shows with the original lineup, minus Paul Atkinson, who's sadly passed away, but the other four of them get together, and they're very well received. They put out a live album and a DVD, and
they really pull it off. I mean, you know, considering like some bands, you know, after time, the voices aren't quite the same. You know, Colin's got an incredible instrument there that continues to sort of
he still sounds fantastic, and they sound great as a band. And I saw them. It's funny, I saw them around this time, or maybe a little bit before. It was either 2007, I think it was, that I saw them live. And it was funny because at the time I remember thinking, well, I better go and see them because they're not going to be doing this much.
Yeah, I had seen the same thing when they went out on the, it was interesting because they were kind of doing the Odyssey tour at the same time I saw Love doing the Forever Changes when Arthur Lee was still around. So they were both kind of touring these classic albums.
Yeah, well, they did tour for a while with Arthur Lee. There was one tour they did with Arthur Lee, and which is, you know, I didn't see that show, but that wasn't quite a show to see. But so they're building their reputation, and they're touring, I think, mostly with the new lineup with Rod and Colin and the others. But then they're still periodically doing some shows with Chris and Hugh as well, and alternating. And they're building up a great following. And as you alluded to earlier, they're getting embraced by younger audiences. They're playing, you know, places like South by Southwest.
I recently saw them. The most recent time I saw them was probably 2 years ago. I live in Woodstock, and they were at the festival, the film festival, and they did a performance and a discussion around the documentary that was made on them, and that was great. Unfortunately, to take it to the end, they're not. Colin is still out on the road touring the Zombies. Unfortunately, Rod had some health issues, so he is not touring, or he's either retired from touring or currently retired from touring. So the best you can do at the moment is listen to the records and seek out your book. Tell us again the title of it, the publisher, and how people can get it.
Okay, so it's called Times and Seasons, The Rise and Fall and Rise of the Zombies. It's available through Hozak Books. I've just been telling people the easiest way is just to go straight to Hozak's website and order it directly from them. It is available now. It's in its first printing. As you say, the Zombies as a touring entity seem to have ended, although Rod Argent, true to form, is still talking about, he wants to keep writing, still wants to keep making records. The documentary, I think, is going to be streaming at some point in the near future. There's some more reissues coming out. So yeah, there's no shortage of interest in all things zombies.
Well, thank you again. There's so much more. We kind of ran out of time. You know, this is only an hour. And but there's so much more in the book. And thank you, Robin. And I highly recommend this book. And you can also read my review of the book at Pop Matters. And thanks again for joining us, Robin.
Yeah, thanks. It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Okay.